everybody! Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for It's All About Food. It's all about food, my favorite subject, food. And a very happy March 26, 2013 to all of you out there. This is going to be a great show. I can't wait to get started. Oh, I've already started. So if you are inspired to ask any questions during this program, do you have the number here at Progressive Radio Network? 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. And if you're listening later instead of now, that concept always just boggles my mind. But you can send me an email at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. I mentioned this last week, but this whole week is my anniversary here at Progressive Radio Network, my fourth year here, and I really can't believe it. So much has gone on in these 4 years. I'm very grateful to Gary Knoll and the whole group here at Progressive Radio Network, and to all of you, my listeners. Thank you. I've learned so much. And one of the things that we're doing right now at my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, responsibleeatingandliving.com, is transcribing all of these interviews here at Progressive Radio Network, over 250 amazing interviews with experts in this food movement. Chefs and athletes and doctors and nutritionists and just people who love food like I do, vegan food. We're transcribing all of these shows, and thank you, all of my transcriptionists. I love you, and I love all of my new transcripts that are up on the website. We have now about 75. Huh. Okay, before I bring on my guests, I just wanted to mention this is an interesting week of holidays, Passover and Easter, for all of those following any of the Jewish or Christian faiths. And for me, I'm not a religious person, but I love tradition. I love gathering with the family. I love stories and songs and veganizing all those traditional foods. So I'm going to a Passover event later today, and I have my vegan gluten-free matzo balls in tow with me, thanks to a wonderful recipe from Nava Atlas, who has a cookbook called Vegan for the Holidays. I talked to Nava a while back, and I love her quinoa flakes that are used in her matzo balls. Really delicious. I've got them with me, and I can't wait to have them later. The thing about these holidays, though, is they tend to focus on some horrible things that happened in our past. Very violent, bloody, terrible things. And we go through the services and the ceremony and say, yeah, this should never happen again. And then usually we typically spread all kinds of animal foods, exploited and violently obtained animal foods on the table. And there's a lot of hypocrisy involved, which kind of bugs me. And what I always encourage doing is finding the good message, finding the joy, finding the light. And let's focus on those things with plant-based foods. How about it? In fact, it was in my religious upbringing where I discovered I was a defiant daughter. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. There's a new book out from Lantern Books Publishers, Defiant Daughters. And we have two of the contributors here today to talk about the book, Carol Adams and Jasmine Singer. So Carol Adams is the author of many books, including The Sexual Politics of Meat, A Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory. And Jasmine Singer is the co-founder of a nonprofit organization called Our Hen House, a multimedia hub of opportunities to change the world for animals, and named by Veg News Magazine as the 2011 India Media Powerhouse. Welcome to It's All About Food, Jasmine and Carol.
Thank you, Karen.
Ooh. It's so wonderful to be here. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You know, I don't know what it is. It could be the plant foods, but I am just so supercharged right now. I'm just trying to stay calm and control myself. But I just might jump out of the microphone or into it, or I don't know. Anyway, Carol, I wanted to ask you, or just see how you felt since this book has come out. You know, many of us, many activists over the years, hundreds of years, thousands of years, people have been struggling and fighting for one thing or another. And most of the time, there's very little reward when people are trying to make the world a better place. And usually the only reward we get is knowing that we have integrity and we followed our principles. But you spent a lot of time writing, and the Sexual Politics of Meat is just only one of the works that you have produced. But you have had a tremendous impact on so many people, and now we have this book out, Defiant Daughters, where they all credit you for making a tremendous difference in their work and their lives. What does that feel like?
Well, it's a great question, Karen, and it's such a gift to me to find out that this book that I spent 16 years writing is out there doing this marvelous work. And I don't always know what it's doing out there, you know, that people are reading it or how it changes people's lives. But sometimes it's like people write home, as it were, and let me know how they're doing. And each time I feel it is such a gift. The one thing I think about is I think about the Carol Adams of the 1980s, who was very lonely and desperately trying to figure out how to make sense of what she was seeing in the world and how hard that was. And I lived in upstate New York, so I wasn't in the midst of a really progressive community. But I say in my preface that I wish I could go back to that Carol Adams and just say, hey, Carol, don't worry. It's all going to work out.
Yeah, it's all going to be fine, Carol.
And so I think that that's the example for us today. As you said, we do these things because we believe in them. And sometimes there are incredible rewards. And Defiant Daughters is a gift that moves me so incredibly because I can see in Defiant Daughters this representative group of writers who are out changing the world in ways that I would not have been able to do. And now, I mean, it's like multiplying. The whole idea about writing is that we are creating a collective response. We believe in a collective response. And what Defiant Daughters shows is the variety of responses that are available, from Jasmine doing our hen house, Sarah Brown blogging at Queer Vegan Food, the creation, Carolyn Mullen creating the National Museum of Animals and Society, Kate Jacoby creating incredibly delicious, innovative foods at Veg, Laura Wright and other writers writing impassioned, sensitive works. There's just such a variety in the voices that show us the kinds of things we can be doing.
Now, a lot of these stories from different women are heart-wrenching, very intimate, and Jasmine, your story, for example, how did it feel to write this story and know that so many of us share some very personal issues about what you've been through?
Well, that's a great question. It's funny because when I was writing it, I didn't really internalize the fact that this was going to be out there. I think a lot of writers, maybe you two as well, can identify with kind of forgetting that you're being seen so vividly in your writing. So by the time the anthology came out, which was almost a year after I wrote the piece, I thought, oh, wow, this is deeply personal. Mm-hmm. And quickly I decided to get over it because, as my partner Marianne likes to say to me sometimes, you know, I'm invisible. This isn't exactly about me. This is about the animals. This is about the many animals, both human and non, who are oppressed in so many ways. And so if I could use my story as a vehicle for getting people to have aspects of it that resonate with them in a way that allows them to maybe open their eyes to the suffering of other sentient beings, then that's great. And I'm glad I'm out there in that way. And more so than just being a personal story about me, I'm talking about my own journey that was largely influenced by Carol in bringing my own activism together with my feminism and my veganism.
We have a big problem today with obesity in the United States and more other countries, but many of the women in these stories, in these chapters, had issues with their self-image and it related to weight, either very little or a lot, either with anorexia, bulimia, or with being overweight. I think there's a specific piece of it that's related to women and women images, not just all these crazy things that are going on with our food system.
Well, you know, there's a famous quote from John Berger. Men look at women. Women look at men looking at women. And I think that we are so socialized to look at our bodies as though from the outside, to externalize or to internalize these messages from a culture that's really still very misogynistic and very limited in terms of what it believes body types for women should be. And one of the things I said at Mushu's on Friday night, referring to some of these gripping stories, such as Jasmine's and others, was that in the Sexual Politics of Meat, I introduced the concept of the absent referent and said that animals are made absent reference through meat eating. But women are made absent reference in our culture, too, through the kind of visual oppression that occurs, the sense that it's okay to look at women in this way. And that what Defiant Daughters does is it says we do not need to be absent reference to ourselves. And once we stand at that place, we stand and, as Jasmine said, reach with compassion and recognize all the others who have been made absent reference.
There's definitely a great deal of courage in each one of these stories, because there's always a point where an individual realizes something is wrong with this whatever picture I am involved with. And you have a choice to either do something, write it, or write it within yourselves. But it always takes a great deal of courage.
Yes, I think it does. And I think one of the things these stories tell us, Sexual Politics of Meat was a way of saying, you are not alone. And now Defiant Daughters comes along, and it's another way of saying, you aren't alone in putting these things together, the fact that oppressions are connected. You are sharing a vision with many others, so don't feel isolated.
I think the first chapter by Ruby Hamad on halal, that was one that I enjoyed them all, but I really enjoyed this one because I resonated with it in a very interesting way. First of all, I rarely hear stories about veganism and people that follow the Muslim faith. And I was delighted to see this story, even though this particular author, Ruby Hamad, went through a lot of pain. But I actually resonated with my own upbringing, my own religious upbringing in the Jewish faith. And I've had a pretty privileged, fortunate life, middle class, but I've always had a roof over my head and food and opportunities and pretty much anything a little girl would want. But prejudice and discrimination, I first experienced it in the temple, in the synagogue, and it didn't make sense to me. And I didn't know that I was a defiant daughter. I didn't know I was a feminist. It just didn't make sense. Why aren't I allowed to do what the boys are allowed to do? It was something really, really simple. And I loved her story. Of course, it breaks my heart knowing that, you know, women are treated in horrible ways and are not given opportunities that men are. But I'm glad to see that there are so many people like the ones in this book that have the courage to make change.
What do you think, Jasmine, of the experience of learning of the 20 other women you are writing with? How does that feel?
Well, it's interesting because as Karen is talking about how this one particular piece resonated with her, I think that that's the power and beauty of this anthology. I'm pretty sure that everybody will have a piece resonate with them in that same way. Maybe it'll remind them of them now or them 10 years ago or their childhood. And another thing about this book is that hopefully people have already read The Sexual Politics of Meat, but I don't think that that is a necessary prerequisite reading. in order to dive into Defiant Daughters. I think that the anthology, which was published by Lantern Books, really speaks for itself. And so for me, as I was reading it, I was also really touched very deeply by so many of the stories in it, including, you know, Vidushi, this young woman who I think she was 16 when she wrote the piece. And I just was blown away by how eloquent she was and how she was really questioning her own privilege and questioning her own ignorance, which is, she's just a kid. And that's something that so many of us can stand to learn from. In what ways are we blind? So that resonated with me.
Yeah, a lot of eloquence there. Very, very impressive. And I would like to think that the younger generations are going to definitely move in leaps and strides and achieve great things. I just have a bunch of different questions. The absent referent, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going off to a Passover Seder later, and my mother always makes the vegan chopped liver. I don't think about the word chopped liver when we're saying it because we've had it for so long, and now we have the veganized version of it, which is just string beans and walnuts and onions.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a problem calling it chopped liver?
Well, maybe you should change it to chopped lives on or chopped.
Wait,
I mean, I could call it a string. I could call it a string bean pate.
What about call it chopped living?
Chopped living.
I
wondered, because I know that there are things that we just don't think about, even in this movement where we're promoting vegan foods and a vegan lifestyle. And, you know, sometimes we don't realize the words that we're using and how powerful they are.
I think that we have to also look at things strategically. I mean, we're trying really hard to change the world for animals. And so maybe if you were having your Passover Seder with Carol and I, which, you know, I would totally be in for, by the way, then we could call it whatever we want. We could call it chopped live her. We could call it string beans, whatever. But when you're in a circumstance with people who might not be vegan yet, or as Carol has called it, blocked vegans, then maybe we're trying to appeal to their familiarity. So, it's important that later we question those assumptions and we question whether or not there is a better way, a less oppressive way of explaining what we're talking about.
One of the things I say in Living Among Meat Eaters is that meat eaters are perfectly happy eating vegan food as long as they don't know that's what they're doing. So, you know, Jasmine's right. Chopped liver, let them eat it and think they know what they're eating. Later on, when they find out otherwise, it's a moment of revelation for them. It's a moment for them along their path.
Well, I have to say that this is one of the most incredible recipes ever. And my mom makes it the best. Anyway, let's go over to rape now. And there were a number of different experiences in the book with rape, unfortunately. There's that oxymoron kind of expression, forcible rape, that some feel they need to qualify rape a little more. But there are different degrees of rape, date rape, versus some really bloody, violent, murderous types.
Wait, I'm going to stop you there.
Yes.
I don't think there's any difference.
Well, that was my question, and it wasn't coming out right, but that was what I was leading to.
Rape
is there a difference?
No. Rape does not require
advocate. There aren't 50 shades of rape.
Right. Rape is not something that requires an adjective. It's like slaughter. Where do we get off humane slaughter? Slaughter should not have an adjective. There is no such thing as humane slaughter. It's killing. There is no shade of rape that's less intolerable than another. Rape is rape. The stories in Defiant Daughters tell us of some very different experiences of being raped, but the experience of being raped to the woman who is raped is that it is rape. You know, she was made an absent referent.
Mm-hmm.
Her will is not considered equal to the will of someone overpowering her and taking from her what what they have no right to do. Rape is rape.
Yeah.
Just speaking as someone who, you know, you probably saw this in my piece, but
yes.
I also talk about an experience I had at 19 years old being date raped. And the question that you're bringing up, Karen, is one that I have asked myself many times, you know, at least for the 10 years after it happened. It was probably about 14 years ago at this point. And ultimately, you know, I also said, well, I was in his house and, you know, I was the one who was fooling around and whatnot. And ultimately, I did come out of it with what Carol is talking about, that, you know, what's the difference? I mean, the fact is that this was a horrible, horrible thing that happened. And at this point, all I can do is try and become a stronger person because of it. And in my piece, which is called Found Art, Found Hope, I actually talk about, you know, what dairy cows go through all the time, which is, in essence, rape. In fact, the industry's term for the machines that they're hooked up to, as you know, of course, is called a rape rack. That's their term, not ours.
Yep. Well, I think that I brought this up because I believe it is so important, because many people want to put an adjective before the rape and qualify it and put it in a certain category, and it's not the right thing to do. It's just wrong any way you describe it. Okay. I was just reading last week's New York Times Magazine. Don't know if either of you get it. There was an article about how there are more and more strong women TV personalities now on TV shows. I can't say that I'm that familiar because I don't watch television very often. But the point that they were making is that the strong male personalities on television, if they have some flawed characteristics, it's usually used to show that they can accomplish something or achieve something. But with the women, it's shown that they're crazy, that the strong women are also crazy.
That's interesting. I didn't read that, but I'm definitely going to go back to that. I think of that in terms of, you know, I've always been very involved in theater, and I think about that in terms of the stage actresses who are called divas, you know, and yet if they were men, then they would just be like a leading man, and they get these awful reputations. So that's what that makes me think of. It's interesting.
Well, that's only true, except tenors don't fit into the male category, because tenors are actually considered like divas very often.
Right.
That's something different. I don't know. Yes, Carol.
I mean, I think that what we're talking about is this large array of representation of women. And that even as something advances, something else retreats.
Yes.
And, you know, that's, in fact, that's where Jasmine and I connect, is through the pornography of meat, where I talk about images and representations. And the kind of insidious, subtle, or not so subtle images that we take for granted now that are out there that position women as less than human, where I use the word, you know, women are animalized. Or animals are feminized. This kind of connecting, oppressive visual statement about women. So whenever we experience anything about women in the media, it's all being colored by what the advertisements are. You know, that they're all connected, that we might see something, whether in a newspaper, a magazine, or on television. But what are the ads that surround that and create the environment for that also saying? And often they're just saying women are there to be consumed.
Now, your book, Sexual Politics of Meat, came out in 1990.
Uh-huh.
And then the pornography of meat, and you talk about these advertisements. And I remember reading those books and then seeing what you were talking about in everything, all the magazines that I was exposed to. And it hasn't changed.
It's getting worse.
I continue to see it.
Yeah, it's getting worse. What do you think, Jasmine?
I'm wondering, Carol, you know, I see these images all the time, and it's almost like the same thing as when we first go vegan. Suddenly we're standing in front of the hot dog stand on the corner crying because we realize what we're looking at, and we go through this time of having serious trauma, and sometimes it doesn't go away, and sometimes it resurfaces from time to time. But as at least in my experience, when I first learned about the horror going on behind closed doors for animals, it was a very sad and traumatic experience for me. And it's similar after looking at the pornography of meat, which you're right, deeply touched and moved me, and that was the book that came into my life before the sexual politics of meat came into my life, and it stuck with me so strongly. Now I'm that person who I look at ads. I live in Lower Manhattan. I see a lot of ads on billboards, and I think, oh, look what they're doing. They're equating both this animal and this woman to nothing more than a piece of meat. I would agree that that's not getting any better, but I do like to think that at the same time, awareness is hugely rising. I mean, Karen, look at the fact that Carol was portrayed on Law & Order as a fictional character. If that's not awareness being raised, then what is?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay,
I think that, I mean, just to circle back about representation, one thing that happens now when people send me these images, they say, I'm so glad I have someone I can send them to who gets it. So, you know, the idea that there are more and more of us seeing with a, standing at a different place to see these oppressive images as oppressive, not as given. That's mm-hmm. liberatory, and that's great. And even the fictional Carol on Law & Order, that's what she was saying.
We just have a few minutes left. Jasmine, can you tell us about our hen house and what you're doing?
Absolutely. Our henhouse.org is where you can find us online, and we have a podcast every week. We have a different 90-minute episode. This weekend will mark our 168th consecutive episode, and even though there's a lot to be sad and angry about, our MO is to be indefatigably positive, because in a world with such angst there and oppression, there's also a lot that we can tap into in order to change the world for animals, both human and non. So that's what my partner and I try to do.
Being positive. I like that very much. I'm all about that too. Let's go
it's
to the
great.
Light, not stay in the dark.
And they're all on the web, so people can listen to the old podcasts and really just become familiar with so many different ways of thinking about these issues.
And Carol,
it's a great service.
What's next for you,
Carol?
I'm working on another book about veganism, and I hope to have it more formed up in a couple months. So let's come back to that.
Okay, we will. Well, thank you both for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best with Defiant Daughters.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Thanks so much, and thanks for being a defiant daughter, both of you.
Right on.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, any defiant daughters out there want to share your story? Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. I would love to hear it. Maybe we could talk about it later on this program, because we need to share our stories. It's so important. And we need to know that we're not alone. And we need to know that we're all working towards positive change. I like it. Why don't we take a little break and then, we're going to take a lovely trip to Italia. We're going to the Upper Tiber Valley, and we're going to talk about food traditions in Italy's heartland. We'll be right back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and welcome to part two of today's program of It's All About Food on March 26, 2013. All right. Now, to the delicious portion of our program. The first part was defiant, and the second part is delicious. I'm going to welcome on the show Elizabeth Holy, who writes about the food, agriculture, arts, and crafts of the Upper Tiber Valley, where she has resided for the past 20 years. She is a member of the Slow Food Alta Umbria and the International Association of Culinary Professionals. Welcome, Elizabeth, to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen.
So we're going to be talking about your lovely little book, Sustenance Food Traditions in Italy's Heartland. And how lucky are you to live there?
I am very lucky.
What brought you to Italy 20 years ago?
Several friends. Well, I've always loved Italy. I grew up on a farm in Contra Costa Valley and here in California. And I'm in California now for this big IACP conference that's going to be happening in a week or so. A friends had this idea of restoring an old farmhouse, and several of us got together, and we did it. And they needed a manager. So I went over, I became the manager, I became a cook with an Italian guy, and became a gardener, and eventually the cooking led to the farms, and I started doing culinary tours for classes, and so one thing led to another, and I'm still there 20 years later.
Well, when we think about food, When we go in our minds to areas in Europe like Italy or the southern part of France, there's a lot of romance involved, a lot of beautiful images, and I certainly get that feeling in this book.
Thank you.
There's a lot of, I mean, it's just such a gorgeous area. And when we talk about food, very often we think it's so important to go back to the way things were. And I don't know if that's entirely a good thing. I think there are some things that we did well whenever, long ago, in different parts of the world, and some things we're doing good now, and it's good to take some of it, take the good, and leave the rest behind. But I love the artisans, the craft that are involved in growing food and making some of the food products, and the art, the love that's involved with it, the romance, the beauty, and we're going to talk about some of those things.
Well, in fact, I love those things too, and I dedicated the book to the farmers because where I grew up, it was a beautiful farmland, and just in the last 20 years, it's all changed. It's now under asphalt, and our country road is lined with strip malls. So I just don't want that to happen to this area of the upper Tiber Valley. This is actually starts where the Tiber begins, from a little stream in the mountains above the valley, and extends down to right just north of Perugia, where I live. And so this is the area that I'm talking about in the book, called the Upper Tiber Valley. And a lot of the traditions still exist. There are some wonderful foods that have always been loved there, and sometimes they're now created with a modern twist. You know, some of the younger people have some new ideas. But it's definitely an area for vegans. If people want to come and visit, a vegan will be happy there. Although they do have traditions of hunting and pork and lamb and lots of vegetables, grains, and also foods that just grow wild.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I know in this book you talk about a lot of things. You talk about a lot of wonderful plant foods, and you also talk about how some of the animals are raised for meat and for eggs and for cheese. I lived in the south of France for 4 years in Aix-en-Provence, and it was a really wonderful time. And I lived as a vegan there, and some people were really surprised to hear that. But it's an area like where you're from where people love fresh plant food.
Right.
And, you know, when it's packaged and it comes from a hothouse somewhere or it's out of season and it has no taste, people aren't interested in that. It's
right.
Fresh
fact,
and it's seasoned.
In fact, you can't buy broccoli in the summer. What we call broccoli calabrese is what we call here in the States. We call it just plain broccoli. And a lot of vegetables that are definitely winter vegetables are not available in the summertime. And then you have your real seasonal things like fava beans and artichokes and asparagus and wild asparagus, too, in the spring. Then you have all your wonderful summer vegetables in the summer. And then the fall brings on, which is basically September through November, you have wine, chestnuts, truffles, mushrooms, peppers are actually late summer, early fall. And so it's so seasonal, and you just simply don't buy those things, and you look forward to the arrival of the broccoli in the winter, and the cauliflower, and the black cabbage, the cavolonero. So, and this area is a lot like Provence, so, and the people are very similar to very warm. You always hear things about other people in France who are not.
I always tell people, don't go to Paris, go to the Provence.
Exactly.
That's where you'll fall in love. Yeah.
Well, a lot of the people from this area also worked in Provence. I think there's a real connection there. They worked in Nice after the war. So I think there's, they felt at home there.
It's something that we don't have in the United States. Either we never had it or we lost it, and some people are trying to bring it back. But it's really this love of what comes from the earth and to nurture it and the gifts that we get back from it. It's the simplest things, but it's what really speaks to our soul, the food that nurtures us and takes care of us. And so it's great to have a little book like this and know that there are places where these things exist, where we might visit, where we might get inspired, where we might learn.
I think it's also the community of eating. You know, we go out to wonderful restaurants. We have terrific restaurants, but we also cook a lot at home for each other. And that social life, and also with the families. You know, oftentimes you'll see three generations living together. And everyone helping each other, that still exists. And I think that's really good for health. There are people in my little neighborhood, which is really about 3 kilometers from a village. They're 90-year-olds still working in their vegetable garden, which is, and they have animals, which they use for fertilizer, natural manures. It's just a very healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, we have crazy things going on in this country and all around the world when we have these intensive factory farms where animals are crammed inside warehouses and they produce so much excrement, you just can't spread it around. There's not enough earth to spread it all around. It's just horrible. And, of course, it's filled with all kinds of antibiotics and all kinds of chemicals, and these animals are fed horrible things. That's not the kind of manure we want to spread on our garden.
No.
But what they're doing where you are is what nature intended.
Right. And then there are also, people are taking, some of these traditional products too. For example, chestnuts. There's one family that's up in the mountains near the birth of the Tiber up in Monte Fumaiolo. It's called, it's actually in Emilia-Romagna. The area around the Upper Tiber Valley includes Emilia-Romagna, Le Marche, Tuscany, and Umbria. And this one family has hired retired pensioners to go out in the forest, or they're doing it anyway. They're going out and collecting berries and wild apples and chestnuts and herbs, and they bring them back and they sell them to this family, who are transforming them into very interesting, into nice products. A lot of them having to do with chestnut. They make marmalades and things like chestnuts with cocoa or rum, and chestnuts and brandy and biscotti. It's something to give the pensioners a job too, and exercise. So
anyway,
they've created this wonderful little business, and there's a lot of that. There's a lot of entrepreneurial businesses going on that are, incorporate the whole family, and some of the young people are very well educated, and so they're bringing new skills and new information and how to market. So it's a very interesting phenomenon, the fact that some new younger people are also becoming interested in farming.
I just want to talk about chestnuts for a little bit longer. I love chestnuts, and it's not something that we see enough of in this country. You can find some jarred chestnuts in stores and the vanilla sweetened canned chestnuts.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wintertime here in New York City, there are even vendors that are selling roasted chestnuts, which
right.
is really delightful. But other than that, we don't use them enough, and they are so delicious and can be used in savory and sweet dishes. You even have a recipe in here that is vegan for
right.
rustic chestnut flour cake.
Very traditional. It actually, it's not for everyone. It's a little heavy.
Mm-hmm.
It has olive oil and rosemary in it, mm-hmm. and raisins, sultanas, and
pine nuts.
It's kind of a pie. It's but it's more like a bread. It's I've served it sort of a as an antipasti, mm-hmm. antipasto.
It
but
sounds
it's,
so good.
It is really good, but it's an acquired taste. No, actually, several recipes in here are acquired taste.
Oh, why? Some people don't like it.
But they're traditional.
Do some people not like it?
Well, it can make you a little gassy.
Oh, okay.
but the back to the chestnuts of one of the little towns in this area was called Caprese Michelangelo, and it's where Michelangelo was born. But its special chestnut is called the Marrone of Caprese Michelangelo, and it was awarded the Denominazione di Origine Protetta. It's called the DOP by the European Union, and this means that it was unique in respect to its geographic location, the climate, the way it's been crafted into food. And the Marrone is a larger and sweeter chestnut. And this has been a huge honor for this little town. And they collect them in October. And they have a wonderful festival, and there are many chestnut festivals in this area and throughout Italy, and I'm sure you had them in France,
mm-hmm.
too. The chestnut flour was milled into flour. The chestnut was dried and roasted and milled into flour. And it contained a lot of water, so it spoiled easily, and so you had to do it very carefully. And so this chestnut flour is usually just sold in the wintertime before Christmas, you know, sometime between October and Christmas. You see it in the winter, but it does spoil quickly because it has a lot of water in it. So this, again, is a really seasonal product.
Well, that's probably why we don't see it very much, because it spoils.
I know a friend here sent for some, and it wasn't as good as what we get over there.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, and I'm wondering right now where I might get it.
I'll bring you some next
time. No, there you go.
Next winter.
Okay, that's a deal. But in the meanwhile, I'll just have to imagine. Okay.
Yes.
So then, of course, there's olive oil. And I want to say a few things about olive oil, because I was just having a conversation before this show started. I love good olive oil. I have to say that I eat very little oil in my diet. I don't think oil is really a healthy thing to eat, and I know there's a lot of talks about the Mediterranean diet and olive oil, but I think when we have it, it should be phenomenal.
Yes.
And fruity and fragrant. And when I lived in Europe, even the less expensive oils were better than some of the olive oils I find in the United States. Not quite sure why that is.
I have my opinion is that it's oftentimes older than it should be. At least a year ago or 2 years ago, I was part of an olive oil panel. And the people here in California were saying that they don't label the date. At least 2 years ago, they weren't doing that. They always date the olive oil in Italy, and they tell you when it's been harvested. So the best is in the first year.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fact. And so people buy their olive oil in around January when it's all been bottled. And that's when I buy mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I have fabulous olive oil. Mm. I buy it from the same man I've bought it from for years. And it's just fabulous. And he is very, very careful about how he grows it and presses it. And also, it's only from one area. He gets together with his neighbors because they have to have a certain quantity in order to take it to the press to get a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all grow it in the same area, and they all know how each other works. And I think that has a lot to do with it. It's really a small production.
Right. So it has to be fresh.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. There's nothing like wonderful, wonderful, fruity, fragrant olive oil.
I'll have to bring you some of that, too.
Okay, so now let's talk about mushrooms. I love mushrooms. And, you know, in the supermarkets here, we don't get a big variety. Although, as Americans become bigger foodies, we're seeing a little more interesting variety.
Mm-hmm.
But I always saw phenomenal mushrooms in Europe, either served in the restaurants or in the stores, and there's a whole tradition to growing and harvesting and finding mushrooms.
Mostly in our area, it's finding mushrooms. People don't really grow them. You see, regular standard white button mushrooms over there, and you see oyster mushrooms in the stores. But, like in our big co-op grocery store, but the ones that are the best are the porcini, which come in October, usually the first couple of weeks of October. And then there's one, my favorite, that's in the book. It's called an ouli, which is, I forget the name. It's an orange mushroom. It's very precious. And I have the name of it here, but anyway, it's in the book. Cesaria, I think it's like Caesar, Amanita mm-hmm. Cesaria or something like that. But those are found, and people go mushroom hunting all the time. In fact, people will dash off, leave work early on in the afternoon if it's been raining the day before and the sun is out. Everything is coming up quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a wonderful thing to do and very, very popular in our area. Usually they grow around oak trees, and if you there are many, many different kinds of mushrooms in our area. And you have to be very, very careful. Once in a while, people do die from eating them, from the wrong ones. But you take them to your pharmacist to check them out if you have any problems. And also at our fairs during that season, there will be a display of mushrooms, which are the good and which are the bad. So the people are, it's part of the education of the local people.
Now, is this just in your area that you can take mushrooms to a pharmacist? And I could never imagine. I could never imagine taking a mushroom to my local pharmacist here in New York. That they would look at me like, "What? What?"
No, it's only, but it's all over Italy, and I would think it would be in France too.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but I didn't go very often to the pharmacist when I was in France, fortunately. But I do remember the once or twice when I did go, they were very knowledgeable and very friendly and rather comforting to know that they were there and had a very different feeling than when I would go into a chain drugstore here in the
mm-hmm.
United States.
Well, they're very, there's more of an interest in homeopathic.
Right, that was it.
Medicinal herbs, too. And we have herboristi. We have, like in my town, we have maybe three different herbalists who you can go in and get advice from, and they sell natural foods as well as different herbs, dried herbs.
One of the things I loved living in the south of France was walking through some of the fields and woods, and there would be thyme just growing
mm-hmm.
everywhere, or rosemary, lavender. Mm-hmm. I'm just not in fields, but just wild. It was the it was the most delicious, wonderful thing to be walking with the warm sun, and it would almost toast these flavors into the air.
Have borage.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what do you have in your area?
We have borage, chicory, purslane, a lot of purslane, sow thistle, dandelion.
Dandelion. I remember we used to forage for dandelion leaves in Europe and make big salads. I'd never do it here. I did it there.
We also have mentucha, which is a wild mint. And I remember one time one of our guests was saying he needed he was making a cocktail and needed some mint. He said, where could he buy some mint? And we just leaned down and picked up some for him from the lawn.
But that's the way it should be. It should just be there for us, the Garden of Eden.
Is.
We should just walk out and pick the berries and the fruits and the greens.
Well, I think it is. Like over here, there's a lot of wild fennel growing. I think there is a lot around that people just don't know about.
Yeah, I like the way you did mention that in some places there might be an old fig tree or something by an old beat-up house, and you shouldn't pick the fruit because it might belong to somebody.
Well, you can pick something to munch along your hike. But you shouldn't. But people do. It's really sad. We have an apple tree that was just full of apples this year for the first time. And I was about to take a picture of it to show the owners. And the next time I went up, they were all gone. So this happens. And, and then there are other favorite fig trees, for example. There are a lot of old fig trees out in the countryside. And, for years, a family has been picking those from an abandoned thing, and they sort of believe it's theirs. So if someone buys that house, you have to understand that you may not have your figs every year.
Yeah.
You have to plant another one.
We have about 3 or 4 minutes left. I wanted to talk about bread and wine.
Okay. Well, bread is made without eggs there, of course, and we have a flatbread, very famous flatbread called Torta al Testo, it's a griddle bread that's made in the fireplace. It used to have ashes on top of it, and it's just a flat bread on a stone that they flip over, and then they brush off the ashes, and that's really, such a simple old bread, but still very popular. And then wine, we have lots of wine. our area is probably not as famous for wine as a little more south, because it's a little cooler where we are, but all of Umbria's wine business is growing, and there are some new, younger people who are making wine in a more quality than quantity, as it was in the past with the old farmers. So things are coming along. The most famous wine in our area is in Montefalco, a Sagrantino wine.
Are you familiar with Quercetella?
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Is that a house?
It's a winery. It's a biodynamic vegan wine, and it's in that area. I had the owner of Quercetella on the show a while back when he was in the United States. I just wondered. It's very good.
Well, if you would send me that information or the name of the person, I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Well, what can we say? We just have like a minute left. Sustenance, Food Traditions in Italy's Heartland. It's a lovely book. Where can people find it?
It's from Amazon.
Oh, Amazon. Very good. And you're going back to Italy soon?
I'm going back on the 11th. I have this big IACP, International Association of Culinary Professionals, conference coming up here in San Francisco on the 6th of April. By the way, my book has been nominated for an IACP Cookbook Award for Culinary Travel.
Congratulations.
So I'm very thrilled about that.
Yeah, well, it's a really lovely, I love the pictures. I love this area so much. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. And I'm going to look forward to the olive oil and the chestnut flour.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com and have a very, very delicious week.